Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Archaeo Animals, the show all about zoo archaeology. And today with you is me, as always, Simona Falanga, and with me,
Alex Fitzpatrick.
Yeah, and in this episode, we're carrying on with our mini-series, which we've titled Where in the World, what we sort of try to deviate a bit from British Zoo archaeology, which we do tend to fossilise ourselves onto a bit much, but bear with us, we're both working British archaeology. But yeah, but thanks to this mini-series, we've been trying to look at various different world regions, and today we'll be covering Oceania.
The previous episodes we've kind of broken down by continent, and Oceania isn't really a continent, but it is a region which does consist of Australasia, which is Australia and New Zealand, Melanesia, which includes Fiji, Vanuatu, and Papua New Guinea, Micronesia, which includes the Marshall Islands, the Caroline Islands, the Gilbert Islands, and the Mariana Islands, and Polynesia, which includes Hawaii, Samoa, Rapa Nui, aka Easter Island, and Tonga. And we also want to note, occasionally throughout this episode, we will be referring to Aboriginal dreaming or dreamtime stories. These terms refer to Aboriginal cosmologies and beliefs that often describe how things came into being. So they're commonly referred to as dreaming or dreamtime stories, and that will be peppered in as it's obviously extremely important to discussing animals in this region.
And then the relationship they had with its inhabitants.
I guess we will start, as always.
For the first part of the show, we'll be covering the wild taxa that are native to this region, and then we're going to be moving on to domesticated species, and right at the end, in the third installment, as always, we'll be covering our case studies.
Yeah, so we might as well start off with some of the wild species that are native to this region, and we will start off with the North Island brown kiwi.
Apteryx mantelli. I'm not even being prompted now, I'm just doing it.
I wasn't sure if you were stumped. There's some difficult ones in this episode, from what I can see. So, but yeah, so it's a subspecies of the kiwi. The North Island brown kiwi is, well, unsurprisingly, found on the North Island of New Zealand. However, ancient DNA research has shown that they were actually once much more widespread throughout New Zealand. In addition, ancient DNA work, undertaken in 2011 on over 100 kahu kiwi, which are cloaks that are made out of kiwi feathers, are worn primarily by Maori leaders. The ADNA work actually indicated that they were predominantly made using North Island brown kiwi feathers, which has been interpreted to mean that it was likely the North Island of New Zealand was probably an area with substantial kahu kiwi production. It should also be noted, because it's a nice fun fact, that apparently the North Island brown kiwi holds the record for the largest egg laid in proportion to its size, and that makes my body hurt just thinking about it.
Sure, that's just me when I've had too much food, isn't it?
It's a very tiny bird, and then you look at the egg and you're like, oh boy, my goodness. But yeah, no, and also the ADNA work is really interesting, the idea. It's something that I've always been really interested in, and I've had some potential projects in the back burner in terms of using ADNA work and ZooMS, which is Zoo Archaeology by Mass Spectrometry. Sorry about that. Forgot for a second. We've talked about these two techniques before in the past as a very kind of more common nowadays scientific approaches to zooarchaeology and looking at species identification. But I'm really interested in that, using that on things that are, you know, in collections and museums that are, we definitely know are from animal remains, but maybe aren't necessarily sure of the species. So it's cool that they were able to identify it down to subspecies.
Well, yeah, absolutely, because it's something that you just would not be able to do. Like, you can use all the morphology and the biometry in the world, but for certain things, you have to use ADNA.
Yeah, especially with feathers. I mean, it's really cool. And yeah, so I think maybe we'll move on from little kiwi birds to something maybe a bit more iconic.
Oh, absolutely iconic. I mean, arguably, I mean, it was, I guess, one of the symbols of Australia, which is the Queensland koala, Phascolarctos cinereus adustus.
Wow, I thought you were going to get tripped up by that one.
So the Queensland koala is found throughout eastern and southern Australia. And of course, you know, it is one of the most iconic Australian mammals, perhaps only second to kangaroos. But, you know, while they're very popular today, I mean, they have always been prevalent within Indigenous Australian culture and occasionally featured in Indigenous art and iconography. Fun fact, they are often referred to as koala bears. Except bears, they are not. They are, in fact, marsupials. Because I am very, very keen on fun facts today, they also have the smallest brains in proportion to their bodies.
Big mood. Relatable.
If you want to go down the fun fact road, I believe they also, like, only feed on eucalyptus leaves.
Big mood.
I mean, not me. I'd rather not feed solely on eucalyptus leaves. But yeah, I guess one of the most interesting recent uses of koala remains, sort of like going back to the archaeology, has been in genomics research, utilizing koala skins in museum collections, sort of like tying into what you were talking about earlier. And this allowed scientists to recreate the evolution of particular retrovirus that may be potentially damaging to koala populations today.
Yeah, it's really interesting research. I think this episode has a lot of interesting genetic and ADNA research that we'll be talking about. And it's also nice to have an example. I don't think we get to talk about it a lot, but there are a lot of examples of archaeology and zooarchaeology being used and applied to more present day issues, especially when it comes to zooarchaeology with conservation.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say, because while it is clearly very interesting to learn about the past and past the human-animal interactions, clearly we wouldn't be here otherwise, to be able to produce a piece of research that can actually have a positive impact on sort of the ecology of a certain species, that's just the big plus, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And I think we'll move on to the next one, which is, I think someone is very interested in hearing or potentially talking about the platypus.
Ornithorhynchus anatinus.
It's mostly found in eastern Australia, and it's also possibly most known for being one of five mammalian species that can lay eggs, the other four being various echidna species. Now, there's one Aboriginal Dreamtime story which describes how the platypus originates from a duck, which was abducted by a water rat and eventually gave birth to platypuses, platypuses via egg. Another Dreamtime story describes how the platypus, in being asked by the birds, the marsupials, and the fish to join their respective families, declines all of them as it wants to remain friends with all of them, as it shares traits with each group. And these are such great stories. It's so instructive of a platypus, because, yeah, a platypus is kind of, it's all those things, isn't it?
Can we just stop about it for a minute and think how wild that is? Because it's still like, I've known that platypus were oviparous, like, for a long time, but it's just, just something you can't quite wrap your head around, like a mammal that lays eggs. And like, what? Oh, nature.
And it's like a duck, but it's also like a little rodent.
Yeah. What? Great. And also, yeah, I do really like the Dreamtime stories, like especially so the last one, where like the platypus just wants to get along with everyone, so it won't choose.
Yeah. It's very sweet. So maybe not slightly, not as sweet maybe, but it's still important to talk about how the platypus was also important because it provided a lot of nutrients for Aboriginal peoples who did hunt the platypus for food, as their tails are actually particularly very fatty. But unfortunately, once European colonial settlers arrived, they were mostly hunted for their fur by the Europeans. And unfortunately, to make matters worse, as colonial era natural science progressed, many of these platypuses were also captured and killed for dissection of their reproductive systems, because obviously that was extremely intriguing to the Europeans, and as well as they were captured for their eggs. And unfortunately, that will be another bit of a through line in this episode with regards to colonial science kind of wrecking a bit of havoc in the Australian and larger oceanic regions.
To move from the sad state of affairs, we have another fun fact, although that it's not that fun really, from a producer, Tristan, who's whispering from the sidelines that the platypus is also one of the few living mammals to produce venom.
The other mammal being me.
And we'll move back to iconic Australian mammals. This time, you know, we've covered the koala. And of course, we felt like we had to cover the red kangaroo, Osphranter rufus, just to make it like sure that, you know, it's the red one, rufus, the red one, which is the largest kangaroo, the largest Australian terrestrial mammal, and the largest existing marsupial. So, yes, much like the koala, the icon of Australia. At present day, the red kangaroo is found throughout Western and Central Australia. And interestingly, one of the most important archaeological contributions that red kangaroo have made are modern ones through, not ADNA this time, but isotopic analysis of modern kangaroo and wallaby populations. Archaeologists have actually been able to identify correlations between the isotopic variability and ecological change, which can then be applied and reused to recreate Australian paleoenvironments.
Yeah, a lot of science in this episode, for sure. It's really interesting. And I guess it's also, there's so much biodiversity and very specific types of species in the oceanic region that I guess it's not surprising that there's a lot of really interesting science going on.
Yeah, if you don't hear me talking, it's my brain is melting from all the science.
It's a bit hot. From the science, it's also a bit hot. So I will continue to bring down the mood then with our final example, which I feel like we had to talk about because it's very important, even if it's very sad, and it's the thylacine.
The Thylacinus cynocephalus.
So probably the icon, we were talking about icons this episode, and sadly, the thylacine is probably the icon for human-influenced extinctions. The thylacine was the largest marsupial carnivore prior to its untimely extinction in about 1936. It was found widely throughout Australia and Tasmania at one point, but eventually it was horrifically vilified by European settlers who claimed that the thylacine were killing their sheep and their livestock. So between this kind of vilification and the desire...
Spoiler. They didn't.
No, they didn't. Yeah. Why would they lie? Anyway, so between that kind of vilification and the desire by natural history and zoological gardens collectors, you know, the precursors to the modern day zoos, to have the specimens of their own bounties made the capture and or killing of thylacines a pretty lucrative business. So there were bounties also put for just killing thylacine, because again, there was this propaganda that they were killing sheep and livestock. Now, the last thylacine was a captive named Benjamin, held at the Hobart Zoo in Tasmania, who sadly died in 1936. But there's still alleged sightings of thylacines in the wild, although none of them have really been confirmed. So maybe they're out there. We don't know.
I mean, hopefully, but I think it's one of those things that it's better to think about. It's better to think that in spite of all sort of the oppression and slaughter of this beautiful animal, oh, but maybe it survived and it's still out there, it's probably a much better thought to reconcile with than, no, we have obliterated this animal.
Yeah, I know that occasionally hotshots will post like massive bounties for evidence of a thylacine, and we will cover this in the next part, but there is a species that looks a bit similar to the thylacine that a lot of these sightings tend to be. But yeah, I guess there's a lot of hope and optimism maybe that they've escaped this horrible fate and they're just chilling as far away from humans as possible, which I don't blame them. So with that extremely depressing thought, I think we'll take a break and we'll hopefully get a bit chipper again and start our next section after this.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we are back with Archaeo Animals, the podcast all about zoo archaeology. In this episode, we're talking about the zoo archaeology of Oceania as part of our mini-series, Where in the World? And now we will be talking about the domesticated species that are normally found in this region, and kind of touching upon what we just talked about, though not as sad this time. But I guess a somewhat similar in appearance species is the dingo.
Yeah, Canis familiaris dingo.
So it's a bit, calling it domesticated may be a bit of a stretch. They are technically feral, but dingoes are canids that are found primarily in Australia, and they are a basal or ancient canine breed, which I think we've talked about in a previous episode.
Might have done, yeah. Because, I mean, I guess in theory it is a subspecies of the domestic dog, because it is Canis familiaris, which is, of course, the scientific name for the domestic dog, but then it's got the dingo at the end of it, so...
It's a bit confusing, though, because obviously, you know, we know that they are domestic, or at least descendants from, you know, canids, but their origins are not really understood, which, I mean, it's kind of the case for a lot of these domestication things, isn't it? We're still kind of, in the last maybe decade, we've only just started to really understand some of the domestication origins of a lot of these very common species.
Yeah, and again, probably going back to, they probably descend from various domestication events in various locations, which I'm afraid is going to be like the broken record for most of the domesticates that we cover on the podcast as a whole. But, I mean, guess we can class the dingo as a domesticate, because, I mean, unless any sort of recent scientific studies prove otherwise, even though they are feral, so in a way, sort of domesticate, they're sort of gone back into the wild in a feral state, they've clearly not changed enough to warrant a speciation of any kind.
No. So, yeah, it's a bit... I mean, the real confusion is obviously, where did they originate from? They were definitely brought to Australia around 8,000 years ago, but it's not clear as to where they've originated. There's been research looking at the fact that you cannot find dingo remains before a certain point. Clearly, they must have been brought here. The main hypothesis is it's likely somewhere in Asia, which kind of makes sense. A lot of the domesticates that we do have, they did originate from Asia. But again, where in Asia, it's still not completely clear. So there's still a lot of genetic research that needs to be done to kind of clear that up. But it, between hybridization and, you know, crossbreeding, and as Simona said, domestication isn't necessarily just a one-time event. It could happen in multiple places. Obviously, I think in our cat episode, we talked a bit about how the cat has basically been domesticated twice. So it's not as cut and dry as I think we would like it to be. So maybe in a couple years, 5-10 years from now, we might have a better idea as to where the dingo actually fits in the lineage, I guess.
Yeah, I guess like it must have been brought, because of course, like Australia and New Zealand are sort of abundant in marsupial animals. Also, like one of the main reasons is because they've not been exposed to sort of placental mammals. Is that the term? I'm blanking.
Yeah.
They've not been exposed to them. Yeah, they've not been exposed to sort of placental mammals as much, because in a way, like it has been shown that, you know, as other mammals were introduced to Australia, the native sort of marsupial species greatly suffered from that competition. And it is indeed like the case going back to the Thylacine was also, I think even before colonials got there, was somewhat struggling from sort of competition from the dingo. So they were brought from somewhere by someone. Is the my scientific take.
Well, yeah, and clearly they were brought by humans, and that's impacted the way that their relationship with humans have been since then. Despite their feral status, dingoes have basically lived alongside humans in what's likely more of a commensal relationship rather than one of complete, you know, cut and dry domestication. So in other words, dingoes do benefit from association with humans, but they don't actually require us to survive, nor does this relationship harm either species. And this kind of relationship with humans is well documented, especially in prehistoric evidence we have with dingoes and Aboriginal peoples. And it's not only evident in the various depictions of dingoes in rock art, but also there have been some instances of burials of dingoes, which share some similarities in human burial traditions. So obviously there's at least enough of importance to warrant that sort of careful burial. So regardless of whether or not the dingo was ever, you know, truly, truly domesticated or even tamed, it was clearly held in some regard by Aboriginal peoples. And there's still that kind of relationship which exists till today.
Yeah. And moving to one that you wouldn't expect is the dwarf cassowary, Cassowarius benetti. Also known as the little cassowary or the mountain cassowary. I know.
It's so cute.
Really.
If you look up any other cassowary species, they are horrifying, terrifying little murder machines. And I believe that there is like countless cases of violence by larger cassowaries towards humans. But the dwarf cassowary is very cute, and I just wanted to give a little shout out. It's just so tiny and adorable.
Just, yeah, so little with its little blue and pink head. Oh, but yeah, so the cassowary is the smallest of the cassowary species, as you would expect, which are a species of ratite bird. That being, they are flightless, and they also don't have a keel on their sternum, which is a bit of the bone that, unsurprisingly, perhaps, looks like the keel of a boat. Could it be why it's called the keel? Oh, who knows?
Who knows?
But yes, that it will be similar to emus or ostriches. Now, the dwarf cassowary is found predominantly throughout New Guinea, as well as some of the surrounding islands. During the late Pleistocene and Holocene, cassowary bones were potentially used for tool production. So, examples being cassowary daggers, well, in particular, which are mostly made of the tibia tarsus, which unfortunately are not very commonly recovered, so in the archaeological record, so they're not really entirely understood at present. But now, because I'm sure there'll be people going, okay, but I thought we were talking about domesticated species, so what's with this little cassowary? There has been relatively recent research which indicates that cassowaries may have been at least semi-domesticated by humans 18,000 years ago, which would make it predate chicken domestication. I just stopped myself from banging my hand on the table. That's my point-making stance. So, while adult cassowaries were likely hunted as well, there has been newly recovered evidence that suggests that eggs were potentially collected by humans. And granted, some of that might have been for, you know, the obvious eating. However, there may have also been an attempt to hatch the eggs for themselves, for domestication. But, you know, so this research is still relatively new, so, you know, there's still need to be sort of additional analysis sort of, and evaluation stages. But the potential of this is very exciting indeed.
Yeah, no, it's extremely interesting. It's, I think, only like a year or two out in publication. So it's extremely new research. It would kind of shake up our conceptions of domestication, at least avian domestication as well. So to stay tuned. Maybe we'll learn more about what is the, I guess, the pre-chicken. Speaking of the pre-chicken, our last example is kind of, I mean, it's in the same genus. It's the green jungle fowl,
Gallus varius,
and it's also known as the Javan jungle fowl or the forktail. The green jungle fowl is one of four jungle fowl species, the others being the red jungle fowl, the Sri Lankan jungle fowl, and the gray jungle fowl. Now, today, green jungle fowl are often bred in captivity due to the potential loss of genetic diversity. But there has been, again, some relatively recent advances in genetic studies of galliforms and the complexity of chicken domestication, which we've talked about previously on this podcast, is always kind of in the news in terms of discovering new things. Obviously, here in the UK, finding the first chicken and the earliest chicken has been a massive project. And yeah, so there's been recent advances in genetic studies that have indicated that maybe it's not as cut and dry as we thought. Obviously, we kind of view the red jungle fowl as the primary, you know, ancestor of the chicken. I think even Charles Darwin is the original guy who singled out the red jungle fowl as the wild ancestor of the domesticated chicken. But it may be not as cut and dry as we thought. There may have been a bit more hybridization and crossbreeding along the way, and that may potentially include the green jungle fowl as well as the gray jungle fowl. And this kind of crossbreeding may have been seen in the various chicken breeds that we have, the variety in skins and things like that. So it's extremely interesting. And even today, a lot of these jungle fowl are crossbred with chickens. So there is modern day precedent for it. So it's not completely out of the question that it may have potentially happened a bit more in the past. So again, some really interesting research that in the next couple of years, maybe we'll have a bit more concrete stuff, but we'll see. I think, again, this episode has been somehow a secret archaeological sciences episode, and that there just seems to be a lot of really recent research being done in genetics and ADNA work in the oceanic region. And again, you know, a lot of these sciences have only kind of recently been picked up and really focused on, you know, in the last few decades. So it's not that surprising. But the fact that it can shake up our conceptualization of some domesticated species is huge, for sure.
Oh, absolutely. So just have to keep our ears out.
Yeah. And hey, I didn't do like 5 different versions of cattle this episode. I just did 2 birds instead.
I'm sure we can rectify that.
It's a bit hard, I guess, because obviously a lot of what we've been talking about with Australia are this introduced species and things like that. So a lot of the domesticates happen to be, you know, species we've talked about that have been brought over. So, you know, we're just getting a little creative, folks.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, we won't be able to discuss at length all the various cattle breeds. But to be fair, like, a lot of them are sort of European and the producer is whispering, quiet everyone.
Yeah. What was the big cattle called? You know that big one? You know the massive one? A funny name.
The big cattle with a funny name. I can think of one breed of cattle that's got massive horns, but I think that's it's mostly found in North America. And I also can't remember the name.
Yeah. No, it was like a nickname given to the cattle.
From the last episode?
No.
Oh, no. That was from a while ago.
Oh, no. I can't remember, folks.
I wasn't trying to catch out here. It wasn't by any chance Knickers, was it?
Yes! Yes, it's Knickers!
Oh, yeah! How can I forget?
6 feet 4 inches tall and weighing just over 1.4 tons.
Amazing. Amazing. See, even though it's not meant to be in the episode, we still managed to bring the cattle in.
We haven't brought Romans in, though, so.
No. But just saying. We could talk about cattle until the cows come home.
Boom.
But maybe it's better if we go. If there's anything else in this segment, or we can go to the case studies.
We need to go to the next one. Bad jokes, bad segment. Just go to the next one. We'll see you after the break, folks.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy 2, get 2 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we are back with Archaeo Animals, the podcast all about zooarchaeology. And today we've been talking about the zooarchaeology of Oceania. And as always, we are at the allegedly best part of the show, the case studies. And I think we are going to start with the zooarchaeology of Rapa Nui, also known by some people as Easter Island. Now, Rapa Nui is probably most known for the Moai, which are these series of giant monolithic statues of humans that are actually made primarily from volcanic ash. And although in popular culture, people have referred to them as, you know, the Easter Island heads, excavations have actually shown that most of the statues are of predominantly full bodies. They're not just the heads. Now, Rapa Nui is kind of the center of a lot of debate with regards to the potential ecological and socio-cultural collapse of the Polynesian inhabitants prior to the arrival of European colonists. Again, kind of that theme of the importance of conservation and using the oceanic regions as kind of sites of a lot of scientific analysis and projects centering this idea of looking at biodiversity and conservation. So Rapa Nui has always kind of been seen as this center potentially of a past example of ecological collapse. However, it should be noted that environmental archaeology has shown that mass deforestation definitely occurred at some point in the past. Interestingly, one of the theories for why deforestation may have occurred is actually centered on the arrival of an invasive species, the Pacific rat.
Rattus exulans.
Thank you. Who were originally brought over by the Polynesians and was thought to have aided in this rapid deforestation through devouring the nuts from the Rapa Nui palm.
Pascalococcus disperta.
Always knowing your cue.
are you proud of me?
I am proud. And that was a plant name too, which I don't think we've actually done. So exciting.
Welcome to Archaeoplants.
Archaeobotany?
Archaeoplants.
Anyway, Archaeoplants, yeah. I said archaeobotany and then realized, well, our podcast isn't called Zoo Archaeology, so why would I say that?
Welcome to Archaeozoo.
Well, there is, you know, there are many places in the world where it's called archaeozoology, which sounds wrong. Sorry, folks.
Well, Archaeozoo, I think it'll catch the mood because this show does feel like a zoo a lot of the times.
Yeah, and the animals are loose, baby. Anyway, to get back to the case study. So the Pacific rat potentially may have aided in deforestation because it just devoured the nuts from the Rapa Nui palm, leaving none for actual regrowth. However, reevaluation of the evidence, which I believe most of the evidence has been kind of taphonomic in nature, it's a little doubt of that being the main reason. There's also in general kind of doubt as to whether or not the kind of collapse is as massive as people make it out to be. So, you know, unsurprisingly, kind of moving on from that, the isotopic analysis of human remains from Rapa Nui has indicated that, you know, of course, more or at least half of their diet of the prehistoric inhabitants was marine-based. And again, they were on an island, so not that surprising, although there's a fair amount that was also based on, you know, root crops and things like that. So not just marine food, but a good portion for sure. And chickens were also consumed, having been introduced to the island by the Polynesians. Now, Rapa Nui itself is actually a really interesting example of introduced species in a relatively isolated space. And I think that's why the debate over the potential collapse has become so heated, as many who argue that there was a massive ecological and sociocultural collapse often use Rapa Nui as a case study due to these kind of unique characteristics, that it's isolated, that's populated by many invasive species, that there's evidence of deforestation and all that. But there's been more evidence coming up, especially in the last couple of years, that suggests that despite all this deforestation, there wasn't as much of a dramatic collapse as others like to theorize. So, you know, the debate just continues. And this is just a little thing I wanted to bring up because I've realized I don't think we really don't talk about turtles But yeah, with regards to animal symbolism, sea turtles were actually probably a very important part of prehistoric Rapa Nui culture, as turtle bones have been found buried alongside human remains. They've been used as a motif in various artworks that have been found, and it was actually a pretty important component to ornamental wire. So I think we got to talk about turtles more.
Well, if people are interested, we could do a whole episode on turtles. Why not? 1 hour of turtles.
If you're interested, as always, let us know, because I don't think we really haven't covered reptiles and amphibians and little things like that.
We really haven't. We really should. So reptiles, amphibians. To be fair, would we cover insects? So they are animals.
But we've talked about the grain weevil.
Yes, but leave poor General Citophilus Granadius alone. He's resting. He's had a hard week. Thieving your grain.
No, you're right. I mean, again, we kind of talk a lot about what we know. And I mean, that's why this miniseries has been a great excuse for us to kind of get out of our comfort zone and talk about loads of species that we really don't talk about at all, unless it's a species that the Romans took back with them, which, to be fair, was a lot. So not as much that we haven't talked about, maybe, than we thought, but still.
Yeah, no, it'll be good. It's something I'll definitely be covering in the future, also because these species, like particularly like amphibians and reptiles, sort of, they have such sort of niche environments that they live in that they're very helpful for paleoenvironmental reconstruction, which is something else we should cover. But I guess enough about things we should cover, and back to things that we have already planned to cover. Second case study is the zooarchaeology of Coody Springs. Coody Springs, Australia. It's a Pleistocene site located in New South Wales. And now, technically, we're pushing a little bit into paleontology here, as the site is probably most well known for being, well, one of the most renowned sites in Australia, given the representation of extinct megafauna that was uncovered from the context there. Now, there's going to be a series of mouthfuls, because there's a lot of species names in this. I think Alex wishes to test me. So the megafauna found on site included, but is not limited to, Macropus giganteus titan, an extinct species of kangaroo that is the likely ancestor of Macropus giganteus, the grey kangaroo. Geniodes newtoni, also known as the thunderbird or mihirung, which was a giant extinct bird species. Dibrotodon, a giant marsupial whose closest living ancestor probably going to be wombats and koalas. Stenurus andersoni, another extinct kangaroo species. Procoptodon, another extinct kangaroo genus. Protemnodon, okay, not a kangaroo, but another extinct marsupial megafauna, which is kind of similar to wallabies. And the Paludirex, formerly known as Palimnarchus, but has recently been categorized since 2020 due to a revaluation of their taxonomy, this being an extinct genus of crocodile, giant crocodile. Although excavations were first started... Thank you. Far too kind. Thank you. Although excavations at Coody Springs were first mounted by Europeans in the late 19th century, Aboriginal Dreamtime stories regarding the fossils found at the site had already been noted. These findings, however, at least added further confirmation to the connections to the land, and then later archaeological research undertaken at the site has been done in collaborations with local Aboriginal communities. Perhaps the most important thing recovered at the site, or the most important bit of evidence, is that flaked stone tools were found in situ alongside the remains of the megafauna, which has led to the debate of whether or not Coody Springs represents proof of human/megafauna coexistence or interaction, which in a way makes it archaeological and hence why it is here. There you go, boom. I mean, archaeologists who originally excavated the site did theorize that it was once a site of human occupation in the late Pleistocene, where megafauna would have been utilized as a resource. So something that'll be more interesting to hear about in the future as well. Because there are, as you may suspect, again, another one of the running themes, there are arguments against this theory of human-animal interaction that are mostly based on sort of the interpretation of stratigraphy matrices. So the debate continues, because the collective noun for archaeologists should be an argument.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, of course, it's archaeologists who their main argument would be based on stratigraphical interpretation, which, to be fair, still hurts my brain sometimes to look at a Harris matrix and think about that. So don't blame him, really.
Oh, no, I love me a good Harris matrix. Just give me recuts and just intercutting features and just, oh, no, I like me a good matrix.
So how would you, what are your feelings about this debate? Do you think it has merit? Obviously, we're not looking at the Harris matrix themselves, but.
That's the thing. It's hard to tell without looking at the matrix. I mean, if the megafauna is found in the same context as the lithic. But then again, I don't know, because that's also something that's outside of my expertise, because you wouldn't have sort of the matrices as I know them, because we're talking about a site far removed into prehistory, which of course won't have any archaeological features as we know them, sort of even in later prehistory, because of course there would have been little to no farming at the time, so there wouldn't be formal like negative features as we know them. So probably even if I looked at the matrix, that would be a head scratcher.
Yeah, you sound like your brain's melting a bit thinking it through.
Yeah, because of course, like the one thing about these prehistoric sites, I mean, normally like you would identify them, so you go down through the horizons, be like, oh, flint scatter, which of course is not what you tend to find in sites from sort of not necessarily the later prehistoric period, but going into the Neolithic, sort of with the introduction of agriculture and it becoming widespread as a sustenance strategy, you tend to find sort of what are known as the negative features of people sort of purposely digging into the ground, whether it's for a rubbish pit or whether it's for a boundary ditch or a variety of like drainage ditches and cultivation systems, or like dwellings, of which like more often than not you won't get the dwelling per se because they'll be made out of timber and usually won't preserve very well, but you might get sort of the drainage gully going around the building. But of course, something as early as that, you're not gonna get much in the way of that.
I think you're spiraling.
It's an argument of archaeologists. So you're meant to spiral, debate, talk, discuss.
No, it's one of those things where if you think too hard about it, your brain starts going into pretzels, trying to argue around itself. It's one of those things where I do like the big questions sometimes. This isn't even a big question. It's about stratigraphy, but even then, it hurts my brain sometimes to think about it.
What can I say? Send us matrices.
Please don't. Please don't send us matrices. I don't want to see them. Send them to Simona.
Or send them to Tristan.
He's been through enough. Anyway, I promise you we will not do an episode on matrices. Maybe that will be a bonus episode Simona does by herself, where she just talks about matrices and how much she loves them. And I stay as far away from that recording as possible. And I think we have reached the end of the episode when we're talking this long about Harris matrices. So, as always, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. So while you're there, you know, tell your friends to follow or subscribe to us. Leave a review, because that always helps us out. You can also find us at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/animals. When you're over there, think about becoming a member. That supports all of us. And there's loads of shows on the network of all different archaeologists who are funnier and smarter than us. and you can listen to them instead. Although I guess we are uniquely funny and smart. We talk about Harris matrices. And follow us on Twitter at ArchaeoAnimals. Let us know if for some weird reason you want an episode on Harris matrices. I won't do it, but hey, maybe Simona will. And I think that's it.
Yeah. See you next time.
See ya.
Thank you for listening to ArchaeoAnimals. Please subscribe and rate the podcast wherever you get your podcast from. You can find us on Twitter at ArchaeoAnimals. Also, the views expressed on the podcast are those of ourselves, the hosts and guests, and do not necessarily represent those of our institution, employers and the Archaeology Podcast Network. Thanks for listening.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Laura Johnson.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.